You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Here's a little tune that has a particular resonance for us this evening. Yes, that's the theme for the Sydney Swans, who today snatched first place on the AFL ladder. But more importantly for our purposes, it's the theme song of the Fighting Irish, the famous football team of Notre Dame University in the United States, from whence comes this evening's guest. He's the Reverend Professor Bill Miscampbell, a Catholic boy from Roma in Queensland, a Catholic priest, and these days, Distinguished Professor of History at Notre Dame University. Bill Miscampbell, welcome to Sunday Night.
Good to be here with you.
Now, Bill, I have given a rather abbreviated version of your career in our introduction because the way you got from Roma to where you are today is perhaps the most unusual or one of the more unusual journeys I've heard of a Catholic priest. You graduated from university in Queensland with a strong interest in foreign policy, joined the Office of National Assessments in Canberra, in the Department of Prime Minister, and eventually wrote on foreign policy, decided for the priesthood, studied for the priesthood in the States, ordained, taught as a priest, and now you're at Notre Dame. Now, that is a rather unusual trajectory. What led you from foreign policy to the priesthood?
Look, they're still connected, John, I want to say, because I still teach American foreign relations, American diplomatic history in the history department at Notre Dame. But there were intersections between the two along the way. I was studying at the University of Queensland, having come down from Roma, my hometown, place where my rather unusual last name was familiar to one and all, but I met a professor from Notre Dame in the US at the University of Queensland, and as a result of that connection, I went to Notre Dame to get my doctorate in history. This is prior to working for the ONA. So I went over there in the late 1970s and studied and got my PhD. I had had thoughts of priesthood before that, but as you may know, I have a brother, Philip, who's a Franciscan priest. He beat me to the punch and he went off and joined the friars. So I proceeded with another passion of mine, my love of history. I came back to Australia and I was very fortunate to get this position as a sort of North American analyst with the ONA, and it was work I loved. But I had come to know the order involved in the running of Notre Dame during my time as a doctoral student there. So there's the connection that makes my decision-making a little less unusual. And I decided to go back, I believe, guided by the Lord, to join them.
The other connection that would initially appear to many is your interest in history and the church. And the link there is, of course, one of the issues that's become a current topic of almost a contemporary political discussion. That is the role and nature of civil society, what it is, how it's composed, how we got there.
Yes, there's no doubt. I have played some sort of role in trying to maintain, if you will, distinct institutional identities for universities, for schools, so that they can make their important contribution in civil society. I'm not claiming to be a student as to how those institutions evolved over centuries, etc. I'm interested in how they contribute to maintaining a vibrant civil society today against infringements, I think sometimes, by a fairly powerful state that wants to reduce those institutions to being somewhere in the sort of subject area.
I'd like to come back to that a little later on.
Okay.
But let's go to some of your early interests in this area and some of your earliest writing, some of the books you were best noted for, was your work on democratic politics post-war, particularly Harry Truman and his predecessor, Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Franklin D., in many people's eyes, two quite distinct representatives of the Democratic tradition. Franklin, the big liberal, Harry Truman, the buck stops here, rock-ribbed, down-home Democrat.
Yes. I had done my doctoral dissertation on the foreign policy of the Truman administration, looked in particular at the contribution of a distinct individual, George F. Kennan, be well known to many of your listeners, I'm sure, John, they would think of him as the author of the containment doctrine containing the Soviet Union. So I used Kennan as a vehicle to try and shed light on broader policy making in the Truman administration. And subsequently, I did a prequel book published with Cambridge. It was a bit delayed because I was doing other things in the order. I served as rector of our seminary for a time. But I looked at this transition from, as you say, two very different people, Franklin Roosevelt to Harry Truman. FDR selected Truman as his running mate in 1944, not because he knew Truman, liked Truman, or really thought that much about Truman, but because a bunch of political bosses conveyed to him Truman would be someone who could help keep the Democratic Party together. I happen to hold the view that it was a darn good thing that Harry Truman was the one who succeeded Franklin Roosevelt. FDR, in those later years of his life, I think his health and so on, was making his vision of what post-war foreign policy could and should be rather hazy. Truman took some time to learn on the job, but eventually got a firm grasp of the situation. I think it's one of the most creative American foreign policy periods, where you have the Marshall Plan for the reconstruction of Europe, the reincorporation of West Germany and Japan back into the family of nations, NATO, of course, all this happening in the context of an enormous contest with the Soviet Union, which we eventually call the Cold War.
And of course, most unexpected with Truman, given his history and background. And you've got the pressure of this little man who just sits at his desk, I'm a shopkeeper and the buck stops here.
Yeah, his own interests, I think, were primarily in domestic policy prior to the war, although he had been involved in an important Senate committee investigating wartime expenses and defense expenditures. But yeah, it's sometimes circumstances throw someone in. Truman, I think, is one of the most fortunate presidents in having two of the great secretaries of state, George C. Marshall and Dean Acheson, to assist him. And he was smart enough to know what he didn't know, and he knew he had to rely on his State Department. There are so many American administrations where there are tensions between the White House and the State Department, who's really running things, etc. Truman actually worked in good cooperation with the Secretaries of State. It's not a bad model to follow, I think.
This is also a period of great social unease in the United States. Not only do you get the Cold War, you have the stuff represented by the McCarthyist era as well. There seem to be, in some ways, a version of what we've been going through in recent years, a sort of culture wars going on about what the nature of things ought to be and the place of the state in the role of the nation. Now, at that period, it was held against the relief of what was going on with the Soviet Union. So it was expressed differently. But you still had that sort of atmosphere. You had the famous Hollywood trials, the Hollywood Seven, the McCarthy trials, that sort of thing. Was that in some way of interest to you and shaped the concerns you have?
Look, I don't see as clear a parallel between the contemporary culture wars and what took place, let us say, in the McCarthy era. Senator Joseph McCarthy was a bully. He was involved in a sort of an errand to find communists in Dean Acheson's State Department, for crying out loud. Here's the Truman administration trying to build up the United States' response to the Soviet Union. And they have Joe McCarthy saying, you know, I've got a list in my hand here of, you know, 100 communists, etc. It was complete nonsense. So there was an ideological element to McCarthyism, which was designed to try and savage and bring down Truman's administration, a Democratic administration. There's a very partisan feel to it. The culture wars of today are of a vastly different sort. They're about the nature of society and what the instruments and institutions of society will be, how they will be represented, and so on. Now, there can be extreme elements, but I think there are real issues at stake in today's culture wars. They're not just the sort of creation of a figure like McCarthy. They're real matters of substance involved.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia, via the web to the world. Our guest is the Reverend Dr. Bill Miscampbell, professor at Notre Dame University, and currently visiting in Australia for a little relaxation, returning home. Let's have a piece of music, Bill, a piece that you've selected. You've selected an old Protestant number by John Newton. It's almost everybody's favourite. Many people these days don't recognise it, in fact, as a hymn coming out of a very particular period in the 18th century by John Newton, Amazing Grace.
Yes, yes. Now, when I was invited to come on your programme, John, I was asked to select some pieces that would be inspirational for me. And I find this particular version inspirational. I have it on a tape when I do my exercise. Let me assure you, when I'm coming to the end and feeling a little down, Amazing Grace really inspires me. But at a deeper level, this, you know, hymn that was figured in a period of slavery and so forth, still speaks to me of God's amazing grace for each of us, helps us recognize our own place in relationship to God. And I hope the listeners will get something from it.
Amazing Grace, a selection of our guest, the Reverend Dr. Bill Miscampbell, CSC, professor at Notre Dame University in the United States, an interest in history and foreign policy. Bill Miscampbell, selection of a tune like Amazing Grace does have some resonance in your wider interests too, in that John Newton was a converted slave trader, and he was one of those who supported William Wilberforce in his great crusade to end slavery.
Yes.
And here is an example of religion as a moral institution transforming the civil society.
Absolutely. Wilberforce, an extraordinary figure, and I think hopefully still an inspiration for politicians, for public figures in our own time to take on some of the great moral questions that we confront in our time. If you know, John, I'm deeply involved in pro-life work in the United States, and I see that as an issue in some ways comparable to the slavery issue. So I do hope folks will continue to see Wilberforce as a real model and exemplar.
It takes us to the relationship, which I think is something you've indicated is a continuing concern of yours, the relationship between the church and the state, civil society. The tradition that we have in Australia, it comes more out of the European tradition than it does out of the American tradition, but there are some overlaps to it. Let's go to an issue of contemporary concern, and one that you were connected with through Notre Dame, and that is Notre Dame's universities, and it was on the life issue, the controversy surrounding President Barack Obama, another Democrat, and you were one of those basically saying, no, Notre Dame shouldn't acknowledge or honour Barack Obama because of the pro-choice, pro-life issues.
Yes, that's right. Early on in President Obama's administration, he was awarded an honorary degree by Notre Dame. And I argued that we should not honour this politician who was engaged and subsequently has been engaged further in pressuring Catholic institutions to forego their conscience on the life question, particularly regarding abortion, that we should not in any way give him due regard because his administration was seeking to force universities like my own to provide health insurance which provided for abortifacients, etc. So I saw a complete conflict that on the one hand, we're in a position now where we're suing the Obama administration, trying to get relief from them, yet at the same time we were honouring him. I thought we should stand firm on our principles and say, look, we'll forego all the great publicity that surrounds a presidential visit. We'll forego all that attention because we want to stay strong and firm in our principles. I think subsequent events have rather vindicated my own stance. At the time, folks said, well, we'll be able to engage in dialogue with President Obama. I'm afraid the Obama administration on this issue is not particularly interested in dialogue.
This issue is a subset of the broader issue, in the way the Obama administration describes it, of what's called Obamacare.
Yes.
That is, it's a consequence of Obamacare. That is, if we're introducing some form of national health scheme, Australians would understand it in those terms, then it has to be universal and the same rules have to apply across the board. Some would say, well, isn't that a fair enough thing?
Yes. Now, Australians must appreciate that it is not a national health insurance scheme. It's a series of regulations about how private insurance is to be applied. So Notre Dame has to pay for and provide private insurance to its employees. So this is quite different to some sort of health scheme that's run by the government. It's the government coming in and telling Notre Dame, this is how your health scheme will be applied. We want to say we're guaranteed religious liberty under the First Amendment, and you can't come in and tell us to do what our religion says is wrong.
But national health in Australia and in Europe has been accepted with the same implications without so much as a whisper from the church.
Well, that's because the church presumably is not directly involved in the provision of those services. If someone comes to work in a Catholic university or a Catholic school or a Catholic parish, I'm arguing to you that they understand that they're not going to get provision of services that go contrary to Catholic teaching. It's part of a much broader debate about how religious institutions can maintain their distinct identity from an all-powerful state that is constantly seeking to regulate, to determine, etc., etc.
All-powerful is a bit of a strong word.
It is a strong word, but that's the guarantee that if you fight now, you keep the state somewhat at bay. Now, mind you, there's a long tradition of Catholics in the United States wanting to provide for health insurance. The bishops' statements, etc., we provide good health insurance for our employees. We want to continue doing it. But you would appreciate that there are certain elective measures that we don't have to pay for.
We have a Prime Minister, a Catholic Prime Minister in Australia, Tony Abbott. A number of Cabinet Ministers are committed Catholics. They have personal feelings about abortion, yet they are not being subject to condemnation by the Church because the health scheme is funding abortions. You don't see boycotts of Tony Abbott at Catholic institutions. You don't see him being denied a reception at a Catholic university because his government is, through the National Health Scheme, facilitating the payment for abortions. Do you think pressure like that should be exerted on Australian politicians?
I don't see an exact parallel in that the Australian system, as it's developed, has this sort of broad societal acceptance. What Obama was doing was introducing new legislation, changing arrangements, and there was a contest going on. I would hope that folks in Australia would over time have developing reservations about abortion practice here. I'm not as familiar with it, I have to confess, John, in this country. But I'm sure you would see that in the American context, when a debate was going to develop about what would be covered in Obamacare, that was the debate, that was the moment. That was not the moment for us to honour President Obama.
Our guest on Sunday night is the Reverend Professor Dr. Bill Miscampbell of Notre Dame University in the United States. Notre Dame. However, I'm sure my inadequate pronunciation will be forgiven by you and others. Let's talk about something that underlies this discussion, and it's the role of the state versus the church, or the state and the individual conscience in the United States over against other societies in Europe. Many of these discussions trace themselves back not to Roosevelt and the New Deal, but further back to the very foundations of the United States in the Enlightenment and the way that tradition has been developed about the nature of the individual conscience, what's critical and what's important. The European sensibility on this, as it's expressed politically, perhaps the Westminster tradition, if we're talking about the Australian English tradition, seems to be far more comfortable with the place of the state in governance than is the tradition in the United States.
Yeah, I wouldn't overstate that. I mean, some folks in Australia seem to have this view that there's no government health insurance in the United States. There are two vast programs, Medicare and Medicaid, that provide health insurance for almost 50% of the population. They're OBJ's programs. But I think folks can overstate the difference between the role of the state in Europe and the United States. There's a very significant role for government in the United States. Nonetheless, I concede your point. There's a somewhat different trajectory in how people relate to the state. My interest has been focused on how faith and politics might engage in this American context. So how faith informs conscience and how then that might be applied in the public sphere. And I think this is an area where folks are still sort of feeling their way. I want to take a certain guidance from the Second Vatican Council, from Gaudium et Spes, which says faith and politics are not in separate spheres. In the United States, of course, we have separation of church and state. But that does not mean separation from faith and politics. Imagine the civil rights movement in the United States without the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and all those black Baptist ministers. The whole movement was driven by Christian conviction. And I think that was very appropriate. I celebrate it.
Folks, that's the role of Christians acting on the state or towards the state.
Within the state.
Yes.
Within the state.
But there's another tradition. Let me give you the example, perhaps the Tea Party, and it goes back to sort of Ronald Reagan's famous statement in his first inaugural, I think. Government is not the solution, government is the problem. And that seemed
but
for
many... But, of course, he never implemented that, John.
No.
Government
but...
continued on as normal. You have to concede not to read too much into political rhetoric.
No. But the point I'm wanting to make is it betokens an attitude that he wanted to convey, that in some ways the government is the enemy, that the citizen has a war to fight against government. There is another tradition that says the government is our highest expression of our civic will, and we should be proud of what government is and what government does. And some people are saying that where we are at the moment is in large part due to an element of the culture wars which maintains this rhetorical position that government is the enemy, and that's preventing any real sense of a civic project, a shared common wealth.
Yeah, I have to concede I'm no great expert on the Tea Party. I'll simply say this, John, that I think you're overstating the role of the Tea Party, which is a faction within the Republican Party, and they're battling over what should be the role of government in the society. I see nothing particularly wrong with that, and I don't see it as on the same level as some of the sort of culture war issues of the 80s and 90s. It's more a debate, as I see it, about the size of government and how much people should be taxed. And there's a resentment in the United States about taxation. There's no doubt about it. And that, of course, goes right from the founding. As you know, they didn't like British taxes.
And people would say taxation is, at its highest level, an expression of how we want social justice to be delivered in the community, that in a complex modern state, we can no longer rely on individual groups and the crumbs off the rich man's table provided by charity. We have to have a sustainable taxation system and guaranteed benchmarks for equitable wages and those sorts of things. And people look at the United States from outside these days and say, gosh, you've got some of the lowest wage rates in the world. You've got a very expensive health system. Surely you can look to more engagement with government that you see in the European systems.
Yeah, I'm not sure too many folks are looking at Europe as the sort of great models these days.
Or even Australia, dare I say.
Well, as you see, high levels of unemployment in the European context and enormous pressures that are going to beset their welfare systems given the demographic time bomb that they face. So I think all Western countries, including Australia, face a sort of similar challenge of sorting out what balance they want. But I wouldn't elevate this up into being some sort of decisive thing. The United States has to sort out its problems. It's not doing a particularly good job of it at the moment, I must say. There's sort of stasis, a rough balance between the parties and not much ability for cooperation. I certainly would be interested whether or not you're putting forth Italy, Spain, etc., as your models for how you want society.
I'm holding up the
societies
virtues
to go.
No one can hold up the virtues of Australia or any one of a number of other the Scandinavian
economies.
But I was really posing it as a sort of an exemplar of that, and a long argument about whether or not ethical values are best expressed through individual groups cooperating independent of the state, or whether it is not quite legitimate to actually act as the vehicle for the ethical expression.
I don't see it as an either or. This takes us back to our earlier discussion of civil society. Societies work best when there are a whole array of institutions and groups. And I think the sort of overregulation by a central state can hurt creativity and it can hurt initiative.
Let's come back finally to your own concerns at your own university to preserve the distinct Catholic culture of Notre Dame. What gives rise to those concerns? You've illustrated one, the Obama debate, but
that was a symptom.
That was a symptom of. So what's the real issue here?
Look, if you're going to have a Catholic institution, presumably it has to mean something. And I believe it should mean something in how our education is provided, the content of the curriculum, the formation of folks. So we take on a responsibility, in my view, not simply to provide folks with a kind of a sort of narrow technical training. We're trying to prepare people for life, for a good life, founded on Catholic principles. This, I believe, is sort of similar thing that should be working in Catholic elementary and secondary schools in this country. It's why they exist. Why have them if they're just sort of some nice, in quotes, private school? They're part of a vast evangelization effort in some ways. We want folks to deepen, enrich their faith while they are at these institutions. Our place is open to Catholics and non-Catholics, but I say, if you come, you know you're coming for a distinct kind of education. It's the worry, however, that the sort of trends in modern higher education in the United States lead to a kind of homogenization and secularization. This is so obvious when one looks at all the great Protestant schools. You know, folks forget that Harvard and Yale long ago, but much more recently, places like Duke were Protestant schools. Duke in the Methodist tradition, that beautiful Gothic chapel on their campus, etc. Yet, if anyone went to Duke today, aside from that small fringe group in the Divinity School, you'd wonder, is there any religious content? But you see, I want to make sure that Notre Dame continues to provide the distinct education. In order to do so, John, you must recruit faculty members, staff, who believe in that broad mission. If you don't have them, you have no chance of sustaining that effort generation to generation. So hiring of faculty has been a crucial issue for me over these past 25 years.
Does that go down to the confessional level? That is, therefore, preferably, people teaching at Notre Dame should be Catholics, should be practicing Catholics.
I take guidance from John Paul II's document, Exorde Ecclesiae, which suggests that a substantial majority of the faculty should be Catholics, and we would certainly hope and pray that they might be practicing their faith. But for everybody who comes there, they should be committed to the broad mission. Now, I have some wonderful colleagues at Notre Dame who are not Catholic, who are more committed to that broad mission than some of, let us say, the non-practicing Catholics or alienated Catholics, etc., who are there.
The reason I raise that question is because over the last 30 years, Notre Dame has been the home to probably two of the most distinguished scholars of Protestantism that America and the world has produced.
George Marston and Mark Knoll. I was helpful in the hiring of Mark Knoll. George Marston was a colleague of mine for 15 years. They're exactly two of the people who I would put in that category of being supportive of the Catholic mission of Notre Dame, because they realized and saw what had happened in all the Protestant schools. You'd be aware that George Marston wrote the book, The Soul of the American University, precisely on this secularization process, which its insidious nature is you never have a debate about will we secularize or not. It happens decision by decision, appointment by appointment, curriculum change by curriculum change, and over a generation, a school changes. George Marston was teaching at Duke Divinity School before he came to Notre Dame. He couldn't get his evangelical Protestant students admitted to Duke. There's a reason he came to a Catholic school. We were much more ecumenical and open.
We've got to wind this discussion up. It's been a fascinating romp through your life and work. Just finally, your background in foreign policy, you started off with ONA, an issue confronting the world today that is about essentially the clash of civilizations and faith traditions. Do you think broadly the West, because of secularization and other things, has underestimated the power and significance of religion as a cultural generator and a cultural shaper? And you see it in Iraq today.
I certainly think there's a lack of understanding in parts of the West, particularly in elite cultures, which tend to be quite secular, people who populate universities, etc. My colleague Scott Appleby has done a lot of work in this, to underestimate the role and force of religion. Yet, I think certainly in the United States since 9/11, there's been a recognition of the jihadist challenge, but there's probably not a deeper understanding of the extent of the civilizational aspects. This is the old Sam Huntington Clash of Civilizations, so that you'd be familiar with, John. That book was roundly criticized when it came out, and yet I think it's going to stand up better because when you have these episodes in places like Nigeria or conflicts in Kenya, you see elements of this larger struggle working its way out. I don't want to put it in strict civilization. You know, there's some sort of Western civilization. I doubt it can any longer be called a Christian civilization and, you know, an Islamic civilization. I don't, that's drawing the lines far, far too coarsely. But everyone in the West should be aware of the role of religion in other parts of the world and think hard and think clearly about what that means. A call for folks in the West to take religion seriously. Needless to say, John, I'm rather hoping that folks listening to this program, although we've covered a whole range of topics, might take their own faith seriously, because I think that when one does, it helps one appreciate other people who take their faith seriously as well.
And let's finish with another selection that you've provided for us, Ave Maria. Now, here is deep, deep sort of cultural Catholicism.
Precisely, John. I was at a wedding at Sacred Heart Basilica at Notre Dame just 2 weeks ago, and there's a practice there of post-communion. The bride will take a small bouquet to Our Lady statue, seeking Mary's intercession and blessing on her marriage. And I listened to a wonderful rendition. I was just transported by the sort of transcendent beauty of the song and the space, and it reminded me of the rich beauty of Catholic devotional life and of Catholic music. I hope that your listeners, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, will get some sense of that. And perhaps as they're listening, they might say a prayer for that bride and blessings on her married life.
Bill Miss-Campbell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.